Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present Ed Bice, Executive Director of the People's Opinion Project, who examines an alarming increase in hostility across the world towards America and its foreign policy. Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who reports on the March 20 Global Day of Protests against the US war and occupation of Iraq that took place on the one-year anniversary of the American-led invasion. And Seema Wali, founder of Refugee Women in Development, who assesses the condition of women in Afghanistan 2.5 years after the overthrow of the repressive Taliban government. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Despite the objections of the Bush administration, 40 health ministers from the Americas have reaffirmed the commitment to the so-called Cairo Consensus, an international agreement on family planning and reproductive services adopted by the 1994 International Conference on Population and Development. The vote taken at the recent Santiago Health Conference illustrated how isolated the Bush administration has become on family planning policy, as the U.S. was the only country that refused to sign the final communique. According to the website oneworld.net, this is the third time the Bush administration has tried to use an international health summit to distance itself from the 1994 Cairo Consensus, which was backed by the United Nations. But the U.S. pressure to adopt an anti-abortion position had little influence on Latin American health ministers. As Colombian diplomat Ana Cristina Gonzalez remarked, these sentiments are not shared in the region. The Bush administration's strong anti-abortion stance led a dozen members of Congress to write a letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell complaining that the United States had lost its influence on global population issues. The Independent newspaper reports that Australia's scenic Great Barrier Reef could effectively be destroyed by global warming by the year 2050. A report by the state-funded Queensland Centre for Marine Studies concludes that only 5% of the coral in the 1,200-mile reef would survive once the Pacific Ocean starts to warm up. The Great Barrier Reef Marine Park is the home of 1,500 species of fish, 400 species of coral, and 4,000 species of mollusks. Marine scientists predict a 1 degree centigrade rise in ocean temperature would bleach or kill coral. Over the next century, many researchers think the Pacific Ocean's temperature could increase by as much as 6 degrees. But the onset of massive coral destruction has not swayed the Conservative government of Australian Prime Minister John Howard, who has so far refused to sign the Kyoto Protocol to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. The two-year, 350-page report by the Queensland's Research Centre also estimates that damage to the Great Barrier Reef could cost Australia $8 billion and the loss of 12,000 jobs by the year 2020. Paul Marshall, program manager for the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park, observed, "We have come to expect some degradation, but how much and how fast is certainly something we can influence." In the 1990s, Chris Whittle was the darling of free market conservatives with his dream of creating a chain of for-profit private schools that could outperform urban public education. Among Whittle's biggest supporters were Republican governors George W. Bush of Texas and Tom Ridge of Pennsylvania. By 2002, the Edison Schools Corporation was near collapse when their stock price fell to 14 cents a share, and the company had lost over $354 million in 12 years. According to The Nation magazine, Whittle was saved by a $182 million bailout when Edison was purchased by Liberty Partners, a private equity company that was backed by the Florida retirement system. Whittle made $21 million in the deal, plus promises of new loans and a possible $600,000 yearly bonus. Critics of the deal say that Florida Governor Jeb Bush and his appointees pushed the deal to save Whittle from going bust. The Florida Board of Administrators, which oversees the state pension fund, is run by Coleman Stepanovich, the brother of a major fundraiser and strategist for Governor Jeb Bush, and Congresswoman Katherine Harris, who was a central figure in the 2000 voter recount debacle as Florida's Secretary of State. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
A recent survey conducted in European and Arab nations by the Pew Global Attitudes Project has found increasing hostility towards America and its foreign policy. The public opinion poll titled "A Year After the Iraq War, Mistrust of America in Europe Ever Higher, Muslim Anger Persists," revealed that antagonism for the US had intensified among the people of France, Germany and Britain. This comes as there is growing support in Europe for foreign and military policies more independent of the United States. In Muslim countries surveyed, resentment against the US is pervasive. Majorities of those polled in four Muslim nations doubt the sincerity of the US war on terrorism and believe instead that Washington's policies are aimed at controlling Middle East oil and to dominate the world. More alarmingly, Osama bin Laden is viewed favourably by large percentages of people in Pakistan, Jordan and Morocco. The recent Israeli assassination of the wheelchair-bound Hamas spiritual leader, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, has undoubtedly deepened the already burning rage against America. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ed Bice, Executive Director of the People's Opinion Project, who examines the Pew Center polling data, what it means for America's standing in the world, and why there is such a wide gap between the world and U.S. public opinion.
According to the Pew poll, what we've done is to have alienated every one of the countries surveyed in the Pew poll, found that the United States was untrustworthy following the events in Afghanistan and Iraq, and across the board feeling in these nations surveyed that America's intentions were not solid, and we seem to have alienated our friends and enemies alike. So it's not good news for America and Americans.
Maybe you could take a look at Europe, first of all, and discuss for us what the opinion poll found among the populace in Germany, France, as the two major nations that opposed the U.S. war in Iraq.
In France and Germany, we have 85% unfavorable rating for George Bush. Britain lags behind, still at 57%. Russia, 60%. And in the Muslim nations, we have Jordan, 96% of the respondents in Jordan had an unfavorable view of George Bush. Now, this isn't so surprising based on what we've seen across the world in response to our war in Iraq. But what a lot of people don't realize, Scott, is that just 2 years ago, we had 52% of Jordanians with a favorable view of the United States. It's really stunning what has happened to world opinion of the United States. We had a tremendous amount of goodwill and sympathy following 9/11, and we haven't just squandered it. It's completely disintegrated, according to these polling returns. We've lost the goodwill and then some. So it's a very discouraging picture.
In these opinion polls, questions are asked regarding the motivation of the United States in its war in Iraq, and go into some detail there about oil and the role that many people across the globe feel that valuable resource played in George Bush's administration's decision to declare war in Baghdad.
Yeah, the Pew researchers asked people who expressed doubts about the U.S. sincerity to answer to what they thought our motives might have been, and oil was mentioned most often. We've got majorities in every nation surveyed, with the exception of Britain and the U.S., majorities saying that oil, to controlling the Middle East oil, was the primary concern, with 71% of Jordanians thinking this was the real motivation. George Bush has taken great efforts to put forward this notion. This is a great victory for democracy, and it appears from the results of this poll that the people are not buying that, that his sell on that is not convincing the people of the world that the U.S. had good intentions. One interesting statistic out of the poll is that if Osama bin Laden were a candidate in a Democratic election, and this is me extrapolating from the poll, but we can think that if Osama bin Laden were a candidate for office in Pakistan, that he would be a serious contender. 65% of respondents in Pakistan had a favorable rating of Osama bin Laden. Majority also in Jordan, 55%. We have done nothing to marginalize the worst of the terrorists. We have, it seems, only aided his cause in terms of international public opinion.
Advice in closing here. Tell our audience the great gap between world public opinion about the war in Iraq, the success or failure of the Bush administration in the war against terrorism, that we see here, the gap between world opinion and that here in the United States.
There's a tremendous disconnect between how people of America view our perception in the world and how people in the world perceive us. A full 70% of Americans asked in the Pew Center poll whether the United States had the interests of foreign countries in mind when making foreign policy decisions. 70% respondents said, yes, our foreign policy decisions are made with concern for the interests of people in other countries. There's a dramatic disconnect. This question was asked of the people in the other countries in this poll, and the percentages are well below half, in the 30 to 40% range on the high end of people who consider America to have their best interests in mind. We are an island when it comes to global opinion, and we at the POP feel that American foreign policy is going to remain ineffective until we have a better understanding of our standing in the world and how we are regarded.
That was Ed Bice, Executive Director of the People's Opinion Project. Contact the project by calling area code 415-488-0618 or visit their website at www.thepop.org. In the months before the Bush administration launched its invasion of Iraq, millions of people throughout the world marched against the coming war. During a global day of protest on February the 15th, 2003, an estimated 30 million people in more than 600 cities marched to oppose President Bush's plan for a preemptive war against Iraq. Despite overwhelming international opposition and the lack of United Nations authorization, the Bush administration commenced their invasion of Iraq with the so-called shock and awe bombing campaign on March the 19th. 1 year later, more than 500 US soldiers have died. 10,000 or more Iraqis have lost their lives, with thousands maimed and wounded on all sides. An insurgency fueled by resistance to the US occupation has drawn attacks and terrorist bombings targeting coalition forces and their Iraqi allies. As the US election campaign heats up, a stream of revelations about the White House rationale for war in Iraq has put President Bush on the defensive. Richard Clark, the Bush administration's former counterterrorism coordinator, charges in a new book and recent interviews that the White House failed to recognize the al-Qaeda threat before the September 11th attacks and manipulated America into a dangerous war against Iraq. On the one-year anniversary of the launching of the war against Iraq, protesters again took to the streets across the world. Some 2 million people demonstrated in 60 nations on March the 20th in cities throughout Europe, Asia, Australia and Africa. In the US, demonstrations were held in 300 cities and towns, with tens of thousands gathering in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles and Chicago. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, a coalition of anti-war groups. After the New York City rally, which drew 100,000, Kagan assessed the achievements of the peace movement since the Iraq invasion.
We mark a kind of maturing in the anti-war movement, in the peace and social justice movement, where people say, yes, we can stay focused on Iraq. We can continue to call for the end of the occupation and at the same time link that to other issues. And that's a very important thing because you can be sure folks in Washington, folks in the Pentagon, the State Department are linking a whole lot of issues. We have to do that also if we're actually going to change U.S. foreign policy.
What's at stake in this November's presidential election, and what impact does United for Peace and Justice and the other coalition partners of yours, what impact do they want to make from now till November?
Well, we want to make sure that the issues are front and center, and that doesn't come down to a kind of, you know, popularity contest or, you know, beauty contest, whatever, that and that we need to be pushing John Kerry to be better on this. That if he thinks that he's going to win support and votes from the activist community, which is a large and diverse and mobilized community around this country, if he thinks he's going to win us over to his camp, then he's got to take better positions. He's got to be strong. He's got to make a commitment to end the occupation of Iraq and to begin changing U.S. foreign policy. So we're sending a message both to the people who are presently in office and to the people who are running for office that our movement is strong. We're not going away. No matter who's in the White House come next January, we're going to be out in the streets. We're going to be raising our voices and making the issues heard.
One of the central issues in Spain after that horrible bombing of the trains was that the government, Bush's ally, the conservative government, lied to the people basically about who did it. Lying was a very big factor in their defeat. What do you think the effect of Mr. Bush and his administration's fabrications, lies, if you will, what will that have in this year's election, do you think?
Well, I hope it plays a big role. The lies, you know, almost every week something new comes out. It's been a year of uncovering the lies. How many more are there? I don't know. And I think, you know, I hope people don't forget even how he got into the White House. That was a very bad process. So I think this whole presidency is built on a pack of lies. The war in Iraq was built on a pack of lies. I think it is coming out more and more and more. We would hope that more of the mainstream media would pick that up and push it even further. Sometimes they do it, and they're beginning to do it more, but I think they have a responsibility to really pick up that story. The alternative media, the independent media, has been terrific all year long in exposing those lies, and slowly but surely the mainstream media is picking it up. We hope that they open it up even more.
Just the last question. United for Peace and Justice is gearing up for a presence at both the Democratic and Republican conventions in Boston and here in New York City. What's your goal in the streets of both Boston and New York when those two political conventions occur?
Well, again, our goal is very similar to the goal here today, and that is to send the message to whoever seeks the presidency, whoever seeks to be the elected leadership of this country, that this movement is alive and strong and that we want action. We're not going away. We want the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. We want John Kerry, as much as we want George Bush, to change their positions and to come out clearly on that. So the message in Boston will be on the issues, right? You, the Democratic Party, need to be better on a whole lot of issues. When we demonstrate here in New York City, we'll be sending a message to the whole world that the Republican Party policies do not represent the will of the people, and that we reject that. It's a very simple formula, actually. There's a Democratic convention and a Republican convention. Not only do the members of those parties go to those or the delegates, but there's massive media attention. We think that's an important opportunity to bring another message out. Our goal this whole year, as United for Peace and Justice, one of our most important goals is to strengthen this movement, to focus on the issues, to come out of this election year. You know, hopefully there'll be a change in leadership, who knows? But most importantly, that we come out of this election year with a stronger anti-war, peace, and social justice movement.
You worried about the police and how they may interact with you guys here in New York City, especially given the penning that has continued from February 15th to today, March 20th?
Well, the penning in New York goes back a good decade, a good 10 years. They've gotten better and better, or worse and worse at it. They have fine-tuned the penning. To be honest, what I think happened today was that the police department knew that they could not afford to come out today like they did out of February 15th as they gear up, as we all gear up for the Republican convention. They were on their best behavior. The pens, while still totally objectionable, we think they've got to go. They were easier to come and go from. There was greater access. They weren't quite as oppressive as they've been used before. So that's a good sign. And I think what it means is not only that they're gearing up for the Republican convention, it also means that they felt the results of a campaign that we launched in New York City. We know that the mayor's office and the police commissioner's office got thousands of emails and faxes and phone calls saying no pens, and that they felt the heat. They felt some public pressure. Elected officials, almost all of the New York delegation to Congress, the congressional delegation, sent a letter to the mayor saying no pens. So they were feeling the heat.
Thank you for all you do, Leslie.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Right. Thank you.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. Contact United for Peace and Justice by calling area code 212 868 5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. Under the Islamic fundamentalist Taliban government in Afghanistan, the condition of women deteriorated almost to the state of non-personhood. Women were not allowed to work outside their homes, girls were not permitted to attend school, and women accused of associating with males, other than their husbands or relatives, faced severe punishment, including execution. Since the US overthrew the Taliban regime in 2001, both Afghans and the international aid workers have worked to improve the status of women in that country. But the situation is still desperate in many areas. Taliban guerrilla fighters now attacking the US-backed government of Hamid Karzai appear to be growing in strength. Seema Wali, an Afghan woman, fled her country after the former Soviet Union invaded in 1979. In 1981, she founded Refugee Women in Development to support uprooted women from many countries to participate in their own economic and social development. Wali returned to Afghanistan for the first time in October 2002, where she ran a skills training workshop for women-led Afghan non-governmental organizations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Wali about what she views to be the most serious challenges facing Afghan women and her hope for women's participation in the nation's new government.
The most serious problem that Afghan women are confronting right now is the issue of security. Women do not feel safe and secure to leave their homes to attend literacy classes, for girls to leave their homes to go to school, to take on employment. And right now, with the constitution that has been ratified and our elections that are coming up, women will not be able to vote and to go freely to participate in this democracy-building process.
There's been a lot of emphasis in the West, in the U.S., on liberating women in Afghanistan from the burqa. And I'm not even sure how much that's happened, but has that happened? And if it has, what does it mean? And if it hasn't, what's the significance of that?
The priority issues of Afghan women is not the dress code. That does not define the liberation of women. It's access to literacy, to education, to human rights, freedom from violations of human rights, and participation in the government, and income generation. I mean, we need to make sure that the peace dividend transfers to the common Afghan person, particularly the woman, because right now the demographics of Afghanistan is such that more than 60% of the Afghan population is women, and you cannot rebuild a country with less than 40% of its population.
The maternal mortality rate among Afghan women is about among the highest in the world. Is anything being done to address that issue now under current conditions?
The Afghan women bear many children. An average Afghan family size is an average of 5 to 7 children as a normal family. And women are themselves traumatized and malnourished, and they are forced to bear children, numerous children, without adequately and spacing their children in a very healthy manner. So we need to make sure that maternal mortality is eradicated. The Ministry of Health, which is led by a woman, a former general Afghan woman, she's a very strong and powerful woman. She is focusing on the issue of reducing maternal mortality and infant mortality. But in order for her to succeed in her programs, we need to make sure that these programs are offered to Afghan women in the provinces like Herat and Kandahar, and where women do not have access to hospitals, to clinics. There are no doctors. We need to make sure that funding is appropriated, that funds mobile health clinics, and the UN needs to be involved in implementing such programs whereby women in the provinces will have access to such programs to reduce the maternal mortality rates.
There's also been evidence mounting over the last year or ever since the Taliban were overthrown that they're coming back. What can you say about that right now? Is it different in Kabul than it is in the rest of the country? And do you see the possibility of them reestablishing themselves in control of the country?
We are very worried about the Taliban and the neo-Taliban. We have, unfortunately, many in the government who are warlords or former warlords who violated the rights of the Afghan people, who are holding powerful positions. And they're the ones that are also violating the rights of Afghan women. We need to make sure that the United States understands that by siphoning away resources and security, not expanding the security forces in Afghanistan, would lead to the resurgence of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda types, as is now happening, especially in the provinces where the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda strength is waxing stronger. We, as women, are very concerned, and there are these signs already where women are, girls' schools are being burned down, women are being threatened that the Americans are not here to stay, they will leave Afghanistan, and you will have to face us. And so people are very afraid of the resurgence of the Taliban movement. The Afghan army needs to be bolstered. We need a security force. We need justice and courts. And for all of that, we need funding. And we need the security forces that go beyond Kabul and make sure that women are given adequate protection. Without that kind of protection, security will not happen. And it will affect the security of the United States, as we saw in the unfortunate events of 9/11. 9/11 happened because of Afghanistan, which was the hotbed of terrorism. And with our attention now focused on Iraq, there's less and less funding to Afghanistan and making sure that terrorism is eradicated in Afghanistan.
That was Seema Wally, founder and president of Refugee Women in Development. Contact the group by calling area code 703-931-6442 or visit their website at www.refwid.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics or guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikatar. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Denise Manzari, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.